Hey everyone, welcome to the 344th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a lot of news for you today. We're going to be talking about Matter. We're going to be talking about Madam A hitting up the hospital and healthcare circuit. We've also got an industrial IoT startup that uses energy harvesting that has raised a chunk of change. We're also going to talk about IoT satellite services, a lot of shenanigans on corporate enterprise networks, an update to the Echo Frames. Those are still a thing, apparently. A new Aquara hub, and a little bit of information on the retail front. We also have our guest this week is Steve Sattler, who is SVP of Marketing for Wiliot. And again, with the energy harvesting, Wiliot makes a Bluetooth chip that doesn't require batteries, and they've switched their business model. They're doing some cool things, so we're going to be talking about what that could mean for the future and why they went from selling silicon to selling sensing as a service. All of this and more await you, but first, let's hear from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Very. Very is a fully distributed IoT engineering firm that partners with its clients to build systems for smart manufacturing, smart energy and utilities, consumer electronics, and connected wellness. Discover what Very's multidisciplinary teams can do for you at www.verypossible.com/services. Okay, we're going to kick this show off in my least favorite way of kicking off a show with a correction. Because 2 weeks ago, when I was discussing the $11 billion Emerson AspenTech deal, I referred to one of the Emerson software acquisitions that are going over to AspenTech as OSI. That was correct. But when I described what that company did, I actually described OSI Soft, which was incorrect. OSI Soft is a middleware player. But OSI Inc., which is what the software company that went over to AspenTech, they make software that help manage electrons on the grid. And I am so sorry about that. My brain just went bloop, 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 and inserted the wrong
information.
In your
defense, you had a lot of letters to do with OSI, OSI, INC, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's confusing anyway, even to the best of us.
So please, we all make mistakes, but there's that one in your brains. Know that OSI, Software for Managing Electrons on the Grid, that is what is now part of AspenTech as part of their new industrial software portfolio. Or they have an existing industrial software portfolio, but they added OSI. Okay, we're going to stop talking about that before I screw anything else up. Instead, last week we also said, hey, y'all, by the time you're hearing this, Google may have had their Smart Home Summit, but we'll talk about it next week. Well, it's now next week.
It's next week.
And let's talk about all the stuff that Google talked about at their Smart Home Summit. Okay, so the biggest news that we took away, because we're obsessed with it, is Google is going to do a lot to support Matter. But there's some other news. First off, Google, in a very googly move, is trying to reduce the confusion of all its many, many projects that can be incorporated into IoT devices. They're sticking them into one platform. And that is going to be called Google Home.
How original.
Yeah. So the Google Home.
It does make sense to me, because when I said, you know, when I talk to people, I'm like, oh, so which smart home ecosystem do you use? Oh, I use Google Assistant. And I'm like, that's a service. That's a product. That's not a smart home platform, right? It's their interaction
point. That's
why
people don't talk to you at parties, Kevin. Look at you.
I don't actually get invited to parties anymore, but that's besides the point. I've always hated the fact that they have Assistant and they bundle it in with smart home stuff to the point where people think that is the smart home platform and it's really an interface to the platform.
All right. Semantics aside, thank you, Kevin, for your 2 cents.
Obviously,
there.
I'm not coming to Stacey's Christmas party.
Nope. All right. So they stuck all this under Google Home because there was a bunch of SDKs, like Casting was over in, I don't even know if they call it video or YouTube or wherever they put it. So they're bringing all that into Google Home so you can find all of that as a developer. So that's good, because Lord knows that Google can be a confusing place to work for or to develop with. Okay. So all that's happening. They also, and I'm really excited about this, they announced that developers can create routines for smart homes. and share them with users. And this is a big deal because if you're like Nanoleaf and you want to incorporate your lights in with maybe the Nest thermostat or maybe the door locks, you could actually build a branded Nanoleaf routine for going away or party time. And then people can actually just pull that down as an established Google routine. That's going to happen.
I hope that at some point they get surfaced as well because, and I hate to harp on this, but it's one of the things I really like about HomeKit. As soon as you add a device, you get certain suggestions for routines and automations that are very logical and probably apply to a wide number of consumers. So they get that experience without having to go through the rigmarole of setting it up.
Yes. And I hope so too, because the other alternative is to do it like Amazon does. And I want to murder Madam A whenever she suggests, by the way,
I have 17 skills that can help you right now. Would you like to install them?
I just want the weather.
Yeah.
She always does that to us as we're going to bed. That's the other thing. I'm like, set an alarm for 6 a.m. And she's like, by the way. And I'm like, this is not the time for that. I'm
talking about misuse of context.
I know.
Like, I'm going to bed now. Shut your pie hole.
Yes. Okay. So that's my own personal thing. But back to Google. Google is also in, this is the Matter stuff. I have a lot of thoughts and they're kind of unformed here because we don't yet know what the Matter spec is actually going to look like. We won't know that until next year, early next year, hopefully, but sometime, hopefully in the first quarter of next year, we'll get the certification. But Google announced the Google Home Device SDK that's going to be compliant with Matter, but it's going to add all these additional functions to help it work better with the Google ecosystem. And my little antenna went up and I said, hey, I thought Matter was going to make it easy to work with all these ecosystems. Why do we need an SDK on top of Matter? And the argument from Kevin Poe, who is a product manager there, he told me that basically it's just going to make it that much easier to work with very specific Google things. It's also going to help developers troubleshoot when things don't work on Google devices. So I see the point. I do think if I were a developer and I wanted to make like a super cheap light bulb, I'm not going to do something like implement the Google Home Device SDK just because maybe I don't have the budget for that. And so if something doesn't work with Google perfectly, I'm just going to be like, eh, I don't care. But for everybody else who's trying to build like non-commodified Matter devices, you're probably going to want to look into this and take care of it and adopt it. And
it seems like an unnecessary barrier that isn't really, it's adding value probably for Google, but it's taking away from the simplicity that Matter is supposed to bring.
Well, I don't know if it adds value for Google, but it will add value to smart home device makers who have a lot of customers using Google Assistant. Because when something doesn't work, I can call them and I can be like, hey, you know, this is working on, you know, my Nest display, and they'll be able to access data on why it's not working. They'll be able to do quality testing on those devices. That's the idea.
That makes sense, but if Matter is supposed to allow us to use any Matter compliant devices across any Matter supported platform, I include the voice assistants with that. And it sounds,
I know,
to me,
right?
Yeah. And it sounds to me like Google's like, well, we want people to ask things a certain way and we want to make sure we support that. So this is not a subsection. This is actually a super section of possible voice commands that'll work with our devices, our Matter devices. And that I don't like.
Yeah, I'm with you. And it's also going to incorporate things like onboarding. So there's an SDK or a way to connect with the Play Store that will make it easy to onboard devices and link devices into Google Assistant without doing account linking where you enter your password in again. So there's a bunch of, I know. So yeah, again, we're going to have to wait to see on Matter, but I'm already feeling like,
as soon as we simplify, we have to decide how to make it complex again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the Google news. Oh, they also announced an IDE, which for people like Kevin, that's important. And so that's an IDE for Google Home. Okay.
I'm not going to be using their SDK or IDE anytime soon. Trust me.
Are you not building smart home devices?
not currently. It's not on my to-do list. And I wouldn't want to. I would just want to follow the Matter spec.
Well, and when it comes out, again, we'll see how far we can get on that, you know?
Right.
So, All right. Moving right along, Samsung. They also announced news this time at their developer conference this week. They made news and a lot of it covered Matter. Kevin, you want to talk about it?
Yeah, they confirmed some news and they announced some new things. They confirmed basically, yes, we are, I'll say they reiterated that they're fully supporting Matter. It's a big part of smart things going forward. And we knew that. I mean, they were one of the founding
original members.
Yeah, so we knew that. And we also know they're out of the smart things hardware business. No more hubs from them. There are some third-party makers like AOTech that are still making the hubs. But Samsung is putting their smart things hub technology into many other devices. And I think this makes a ton of sense. And by many other devices, I mean televisions and smart refrigerators and such. And it makes sense to me because rather than have a standalone single-purpose hub hardware box, you have most of the chips available and most of the compute that you need in these appliances. So really, add a couple radios, add your software, and now you've got quote-unquote hubs around the house without having the standalone hub, right? So I think this is a very smart play on their part. That, I mean, they sell a lot of televisions and a lot of fridges. I couldn't tell you the numbers, but yeah, I mean, all of our appliances are Samsung. None of them are smart, but we weren't paying extra at that time. So it is what it is.
I will say Matter does not support appliances. It does support TVs, or rather, no, that's actually the way to think of it. But they don't support appliances. So if you have like a Samsung dishwasher, it's not like your Samsung dishwasher is going to be able to tell your SmartThings hub when it's done necessarily using Matter. It could totally do it via Samsung's own data models, but not using Matter. Okay, that was it.
Right. But yeah, and that gets to the point where you're right, that certain devices won't be Matter compliant, but you'll still be able to control Matter devices from them. Like maybe you've got that smart fridge where they have the fridge hub, the touchscreen that Samsung makes on the fridge. You know, I wouldn't be surprised that you wouldn't be able to see all of your devices, your smart home devices, and be able to turn lights on and off if you want. Or if you don't want to touch things, you could always use Bixby.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, I was giving you a pause there to see what your reaction was, and that's exactly what I expected. Now, I've been down on Bixby as well. I mean, frankly, it's just never been up to snuff by comparison to the other digital assistants, but they haven't given up. And I'm kind of glad because I think choice is good. They've got Bixby on 300 million Samsung devices. The vast majority of those are Galaxy phones, I'm sure, but they have on the most recent ones, and I might imagine this will filter through to other devices, on-device AI and natural language processing with Bixby. So better privacy there, quicker voice interactions. In fact, Samsung says Bixby is now 35% faster on its newest devices, which are like the Galaxy Fold 3 and such. So again, it's not on all devices yet, but that's coming. Additionally, they've got a Bixby Home platform, which we were just talking about Google adding an interaction layer that maybe we don't need. Samsung thinks there needs to be a layer between Bixby and SmartThings. So the Bixby Home platform is that layer for developers to have voice commands translated by Bixby and then control devices. I don't know about that one. Yeah.
I'm just going to make that noise. Okay.
Yeah.
So that is big news from Samsung and Google. Let's talk about Amazon. Last week in the newsletter, I was like, hey, look, everybody's talking about Matter. And Amazon's been kind of like, meh. But over the weekend, Nick Weaver, the CEO of Eero, which is the Wi-Fi routers and owned by Amazon, said, hey, our routers have Thread in them. They've always had Thread in them. Nick Weaver has been a huge Thread fan. I remember talking to him about it like in 2014 or something. And now he confirmed that they will support Matter over the Thread that's in our Eero routers. So, yay!
Well, and that brings to mind a bigger picture in that everyone who is anyone in this space has been talking about Matter and Thread, except mostly Amazon. And I wonder, did he tip their hand there that finally they're going to get on board?
Well, he was asked directly. And I think he was asked directly because Amazon doesn't talk a lot about Matter. And honestly, why would they? Amazon has the most name brand recognition. It has the largest number of devices that work with Madam A. You know, it has an established business regardless of interoperability, right? So it's probably like, yeah, we're going to do Matter, but we've got all this other stuff we've got to support, including our own stuff that people are happy to work with because we have a huge dominant position in the smart home, right? So I see why they don't, you know, they're not like, ooh, Matter. Everyone else is kind of coming from behind and they're like, ooh, Matter will make us interoperable with, you know, everybody. You know what I'm saying?
I do. And what's always worried me about the situation, though, is when Amazon came out with its, was it Zigbee or Z-Wave inside the Echo Hub?
Zigbee.
Yeah, it was a kind of a closed Zigbee. Like, it'll work with Amazon Zigbee devices. So I don't want to see, like, Amazon Matter devices, which should never happen, but...
No, that won't happen. But yeah, I see. I mean, it's possible that Amazon will be like, yeah, we're supporting Matter, but you've got to meet us, like, you know, if you see where Google is, like, saying... Hey, we're going to support Matter. Matter's going to get you halfway there, and then we're going to get you an SDK to get you the rest of the way there, right? Amazon may be like, we're supporting Matter, and you can come halfway, and then the rest of the way you can, you know.
Figure it out yourself.
Yeah, I don't think they'll do that, though.
Just ask Madam A. There's probably a skill for that.
All right. Speaking of Madam A, Madam A is heading into hospitals and senior living facilities. So this is big news. On Monday, Amazon said that the Echo Show devices will be deployed in hospitals and senior living facilities. And this is part of Amazon's Smart Properties division. And Smart Properties has actually, they support offices, they support multifamily dwelling units, so apartment kind of complexes, dorms, that sort of thing. And they support hotels. So they have a different business line for each of those. And now healthcare has both hospitals and senior living facilities. Each platform is a little bit different, but on the senior living side, what they're going to be doing is the Echo Shows during the pandemic, they configured them to allow people to call their loved ones and have video calls. And it was really nice because usually in a senior living facility, you actually have to make appointments to talk to your loved one because usually a caregiver or nurse has to help with that, right?
Mm, I can hardly wait for that.
Yeah, it's not ideal. I mean, it depends on how capable your person is, I guess, the person you're trying to contact.
I want my phone call. I get one phone call.
Yeah, I mean, it is sad, right? I mean, so that's, I think, a good use case. And in the hospitals, it's not really about contacting loved ones. It's actually about allowing nurses to check in on patients. And I talked to someone with Amazon Smart Properties, and I was like, well, what if the patient doesn't want to use this? They don't actually have to, even though it does reduce the workload on nurses because they can just, you know, when you hit the call button, the nurse comes to check on you, right? And then they're like, I need a blanket. And then they have to go back. This way, you can just like ping them at the nurse's station on the Echo and say, I need a blanket. And then they can send someone. So it reduces the amount of time back and forth. That's good. But if you don't want to use it, you don't have to. So this is still voluntary. Yay. These are all HIPAA compliant. So the data is not sent to Amazon. It's all locally kept in the hospital. And you can turn off the cameras and mics as wanted or needed. So Amazon's really trying to make it less of an intrusion. But I can see the value in these devices in these settings.
Yeah, it's always good to find valuable use cases for these types of technologies. Otherwise, they're just... things, you know, they don't add value. So I think it's great.
So I think with things like the pandemic, these things have really proven their value because, you know, if you were a COVID patient, you know, a nurse had to get all in protective gear to go in, and that's a lot. And this allows for some communication, even though you're not physically with someone. I don't know. Okay. Let's talk about industrial IoT. Yay, Kevin. Augury, which is a company I followed for years, and I love it. They are a company that they built a technology to track and analyze vibration and sound and other things now that they started out in that world without batteries. They have raised $180 million, and they have a more than $1 billion valuation, although we don't really care about valuations here. But they've raised a total of $286 million. This round was led by Baker Hughes, and they had their return investors included the venture arm of Schneider Electric, Insight Partners, Qualcomm Ventures, the HSB Fund of Munich Re. This is great news for them, and I am really excited. Augury has been on the podcast before. Their customers are like Colgate Palmolive. They've saved them like many toothpaste tubes over time because they're able to diagnose when a machine in an industrial setting is going to fail, and then they stop that. So, yay. Other clients include Pepsi, Hershey's. It's good. Oh, they tell us that Colgate-Palmolive saved 2.8 million tubes of toothpaste by avoiding a single machine failure, thanks to Augury's software and sensors.
As long as I can get my Hershey bars quicker.
Yeah, I don't know if those are quicker or they just, you know, cheaper to produce. Who knows? But the bottom line
is...
That's
even better.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to pass those savings on to you. They're going to be eaten up by shipping and all kinds of crazy stuff right now. Know that, Kevin? We're living in the worst timeline.
This is true.
So speaking of the worst timeline, oh no, Palo Alto Networks has released their IoT Connected Enterprise Security Report for 2021. And basically what they found is, hey, the pandemic sent everyone home. And when you're working remotely, you open up all sorts of avenues of attack into the corporate network. Oops.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 81% of people interviewed said that, hey, when we sent people home, that led to greater vulnerability from unsecured IoT devices on the network. 78% of respondents said that there was an increased number of IoT security incidents for their organization. And this is something we've actually written about. I wrote about it a while back with regards to healthcare, because I was like, oh man, if we add all these like remote patient monitoring things to people's homes, the consumer becomes responsible for securing their network and these devices on their network. So, because some of them will be sending data back to a hospital.
And you're distributing threat vector now too. Instead of one centralized organization, you've got thousands potentially of, not good.
And these people aren't beholden to you. You can't train them. You're not responsible for them. I mean, ugh. So most people surveyed, they said, hey, most of them were not ready for anything, like 97%. Ridiculous. 1 in 4 said they need an IoT security strategy overhaul. Biggest problems for them were threat protection at 59%, risk assessment at 55%, IoT device context for security teams, and device visibility inventory. Yeah. So I don't know what to say. I'm like,
more VPNs at home. That's
I don't know
my
if
guess.
VPNs at home are the answer or how we're going to lock this down.
Well, I mean, I think they'll protect the corporate networks and data, you know.
They will. Some of the biggest things that people are worried about actually are medical device things. So 42% of people are worried about Internet of Medical Thing devices, 32% connected wearables. Blah.
Yeah.
Okay. So little bad news there, I guess. Bad news? Grim news?
Do we have any good news?
Oh, we do. I forgot to tell you about Inmarsat's ELERA program.
Okay.
I don't know if that... that's not really good news. It's just news. I actually wrote about Inmarsat's ELERA platform a couple weeks ago because Hiber, which is an IoT satellite network that's no longer launching their own satellites and is instead using Inmarsat satellites, is using it, the ELERA network. But Inmarsat said basically they're launching it today. Anybody who wants to provide satellite IoT services can use it. And the reason why we might see companies actually doing this is because they've realized that even with the economics of CubeSats, it's still expensive to build an IoT network from space and sign up customers in the amount of time it takes to recoup the investment you made in sending all those things to space. And because CubeSats, SmallSats, NanoSats, all of these fail much more quickly, you know, there's a continuous launch cycle you have to keep investing in. And so far, the economics aren't working out for most of the players unless they've raised $1 billion or so. So Inmarsat's bullish on this particular platform. And now we'll leave the sky and go down back to Earth.
Yeah. Actually, we talked about Amazon earlier today, but they've got some news that literally just broke today, the day we're recording this show. For people who are interested in the Echo Frames, which, Stacey, you are not, yes?
I am not.
Yes.
And you tried them, and you are
and
not.
And I am not. but some people are, and maybe they want some more color options. This is the least bit exciting part of the news, so hang in there.
Wait, is one of the colors orange?
No. Quartz Gray and Pacific Blue. Yeah, those are two new colors. So you can get those with sunglasses, blue light filtering lens options, put your own lenses in, etc. But more interesting, they've added some new features to the Echo Frames. Now you can long press the touchpad and have your top contact be called. So whoever is your number one on the list is just a touch away, which is very nice. I could certainly see myself doing that for my wife's phone number.
I'm like, oh, that would be the takeout pizza place.
Oh, yeah.
I need a pepperoni.
Well, in your defense, the takeout pizza place could be my wife's number one, but my number one would be my wife. So I could just call her and say, hey, can you call the pizza place? They have a new sleep mode to save juice, which is nice. They'll automatically turn on when you put the glasses on your face, and they will automatically go into a low power mode when you turn them upside down. So good use of the sensors there. They originally had auto volume to adjust for ambient noise because they have microphones and they can hear what's around you. So in a loud environment, maybe it boosts up your music or your phone call, but it only would do that at the beginning of your listening session, whatever activity that was. Now it's dynamic. Dynamic auto volume will constantly adjust. So that's good. You can change your echo wake word from Madam A to Echo. So at least you get one more chance, one more choice there. And although you can already send text messages, I believe, to Android devices, in the coming months, you'll be able to send them to iOS users. So interesting how they're doing that. I mean, because normally that's dependent upon an iOS setting, but I don't know how they're doing that. So,
all right.
Still not buying them?
Still not buying them. But that's okay. Here's another thing I won't buy, but you might. The Aquara Hub E1 now is out. This is a HomeKit hub, or rather, this is a hub that connects your HomeKit stuff to other things, right?
It supports HomeKit as well as Google and Madam A.
Right. So it kind of links the two, mm-hmm. which is popular for people. They've launched a new USB-powered smart home controller. It's basically a little dongle for adding
Zigbee devices and yeah. Well, no, I mean, so there are some people that have older Zigbee devices or have Aquara products, and maybe they're like me and they don't want to hog up a whole electrical outlet with a one-purpose box like a hub. This is a hub. It doesn't use an outlet. You plug it into any powered USB port that's on your network. It also acts as a wireless repeater over Wi-Fi for 2.4 gigahertz devices.
Nice. And it's only
$29.99 and no outlet, just a USB port.
Woo. All right. So that exists. That exists if you would like it.
Okay.
And no, I mean, not a lot to say.
It's not for us, but hey, let's put it this way. They used to charge $50, $60, $80, $100 for a hub. Now it's down to $29 or $30 rather. It's smaller. It acts as a repeater and you can plug it in anywhere you get a USB port. I'm not a hub guy, but I like the approach.
You're going to be a dongle guy. That's what I'm going to call you.
Nope, I won't do that either, but still.
All right. Actually, this is good news because it shows that retailers are paying attention to the smart devices on their shelves, maybe. Home Depot and Best Buy have pulled Chinese cameras from their shelves. They've pulled cameras from Lorex and EasyViz from their stores. This is linked to human rights abuses. So these are cameras that are camera makers. They're a subsidiary of Dahua Technologies and Hikvision Vision. Both of these are on a U.S. government economic blacklist because of their participation in surveillance and suppression of the Uyghurs in China. Sorry, that was a lot. And so what is happening here is Home Depot and Best Buy are like, okay, we're going to actually take responsibility for what's on our shelves, which is honestly...
It's a good thing.
So this is good because I think retailers need to be more responsible and aware of what's on their shelves. And this isn't just because like these cameras are on an economic blacklist. I think it's important they pay attention to things like, hey, this particular device is no longer being supported by security updates from the company. We should remove this from the shelves. Ideally, the company will tell them to remove it from their shelves. But I do think it's something that they need to be more aware of, because there's been times, you know, when you go to Best Buy and the sale end cap is like smart home products that have been bricked. And I'm like, what? Why is this here? People should not be allowed to buy this. Anyway, so I'm just going to call that a positive, I guess. All right. Well, that concludes the news this week. Let us go to the Internet of Things podcast hotline. This is the segment of the show where we listen to what you have to ask us, and hopefully we'll answer your questions. You can call us on the podcast hotline at 512-623-7424. And this month, the hotline is sponsored by Blues wireless. And I am really excited about this company because I think it changes the economics of building connected things. So Bluetooth Wireless provides the Note Card. This is a cellular and GPS-enabled device-to-cloud data system on a module. Each Note Card comes prepackaged with 500 megabytes of usable data for the next 10 years, and that'll cost $69 or less. Connectivity is globally available in more than 136 countries, and you can learn more about Blues at blues.io. Oh, and if you call in the next few days, so before the end of October, you'll be entered to win a string of Twinklies smart lights. This is very exciting, y'all. Y'all should just call right now at 512-623-7424 and ask us your silliest questions or your most difficult ones. Let's hear from Michael, who has a question about his LifeX light strips.
Hi, Stacey and Kevin. This is Michael from Rochester. I have some LifeX light strips underneath some cabinets in my kitchen, and I'm looking for a way to physically, with some kind of light switch, turn them on and off that will still keep them powered up so that I can use voice commands on my phone. I do not have a neutral wire running through my home, so I'm wondering if you know of any smart light switch or button, something that you can use without a neutral wire that I could use to physically turn on and possibly brighten and dim the light, or something battery powered, maybe like the Philips Hue dimmer switch, or Senglet has a dimmer switch, something that would work with smart things that I could tie in with my LifeX light strip. Any information you guys can give me would be greatly appreciated. Thank you so much and have a great day.
So with our kitchen that was just remodeled, we have under cabinet lights, light strips. They're not smart. I don't know if mine are set up the same way that Michael's are. I literally have a hidden plug, not a smart plug, just a regular outlet in one of the cabinets, and that is tied to a regular light switch. I actually bought and have not yet installed a Lutron smart switch and dimmer for those lights. But I also have neutral wires, so I don't have the challenge that he may have. But I would imagine he's got a couple of different options here.
He does, and we'll go through the switch options first. So GE makes a Wi-Fi, possibly the least complicated, although I'm not sure if your LifeX lights are controlled by a switch. But if they are, it's a little unclear to me. But if they are, GE makes a Wi-Fi capable dimmer switch for $50. You can buy it on Amazon. That's no neutral wire required. It's C by GE. So that is one. They also make a $35 or $36 on off switch if you don't want a dimmer. So that's another option in the switch without a neutral wire. Or if they are plugged into an outlet, you can actually add a smart outlet, and there's a bunch of different ways you could do that. Because you say you have Samsung SmartThings, you could just add a SmartThings outlet and just control it on and off via that, and you would still have voice control capabilities with all of these. The other option is like a little battery-powered switch that the Samsung makes one that's like, I don't know if it's Zigbee or Z-Wave, but you could take your pick, and you could set up a recipe over the hub to, when you click that switch, it turns on the power to those lights. That actually requires a smart outlet and the button, now that I think about it.
Well, he said smart things, and LifeX, I believe, is supported by smart things. And if that's the case, something like a small button could do the trick where...
Well, he still needs a smart outlet, doesn't he?
Not if the LifeX bulbs are controllable through smart things. He could use a button to send and have to create like a connection, basically, between the two. I guess an automation or a routine when I click.
It is a cloud-to-cloud connection for SmartThings and
LifeX. So if he were to have a button that he presses, then that would signal to SmartThings, the hub, that, hey, I want to run this routine that shuts off the LifeX lights or turn them on. So he could do it inexpensively with a button, I think. Again, it's tricky because we don't quite know all the details of his setup.
Yes, but that could get you there. The caveat on that one is if your internet's out, because it's a cloud-to-cloud connection, it's not going to keep state and it's not going to work.
Right.
Whereas if you do something with a light switch and it's all locally controlled, you should be okay. Although
you might have to physically use the switch.
Yeah. Anyway, so I hope that's helped you. This is actually not a hard problem, I don't think.
It really does depend on the current setup of these under-counter lights, how they're getting power, is there a switch to that power, etc. So I think we've outlined options for every possible setup there.
Yes, if you have a different setup, feel free to call us back and tell us. But thank you so much for calling us. And y'all, if you would like us to provide an answer for you, you can call us at 512-623-7424. If you call us before October 31st at midnight Eastern, you will be entered to win the Twinklies smart Christmas lights, or I use mine year round, but you know, you can do you. So give us a call there and provide as much information as you can, because that does help us figure out the best solution for you. And yeah, that concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Steve Statler, who is the SVP of marketing at Wiliot. We're going to be talking about moving from a chip-based business to a sensing-as-a-service business. We're also going to be talking about what it means to have Bluetooth beacons everywhere in our lives. It's kind of scary. Stay tuned for this. But first, a message from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Fairy. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Very, a leading IoT engineering firm, and I have Bill Flaherty here, who is the hardware practice lead at Very, ready to talk to us. All right, Bill, so I understand that your team has a fairly unique approach to hardware development. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right, Stacey. Most hardware development practices are decades old, and while software development practices have evolved, hardware is mostly stuck in the 20th or even 19th centuries. Instead of accepting the status quo, we've got a new way of doing things, agile hardware development.
All right, agile hardware development. That sounds interesting, but what does that actually mean?
Well, just like for software, agile hardware focuses on encouraging tight team collaboration, constant interaction with the customer, and being receptive to change, rather than tied to a requirements document. We focus on designing and prototyping small bites of work instead of trying to engineer the whole system all at once. That allows us to iterate quickly, identify issues sooner, and get to market faster.
Excellent. So Very is a 100% remote company. How does that work with hardware development?
We have advanced hardware labs in each engineer's home. That means we can build a prototype for clients quickly and efficiently. We can build, break, and repair hardware on a very rapid cadence.
Oh, so you're breaking hardware on purpose?
Yes. When a large hardware prototype fails after years of development, it can be both financially and emotionally devastating for the team. The difference with Agile is that we're building and breaking hardware early and often. Then we use that feedback to improve the design while the product is still in development. That may sound pricey, but over the long run, it'll save the organization money. It's kind of like the difference between a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage and a balloon mortgage. If you invest in breaking hardware prototypes early and often, you won't have that huge bill come due at the end of the project.
Nice. All right, Bill. Where do I go to learn more about how Very can help me with my IoT project?
You can reach out to us at verypossible.com/Stacy. That's verypossible.com/STACEY.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Steve Statler, who is the Senior Vice President of Marketing at Wiliot. Hello, Steve. How are you today?
Great. Stacey, it's a real privilege to get to chat with you. I listen to you so often, it feels a little weird, I have to say, but it's good.
It might get weirder. Who knows? We're excited because I talked to you all the way back in 2017 when y'all were just a baby startup. And now y'all have produced, my gosh, 10 energy harvesting Bluetooth beacons. I was so excited about the technology back then because we need energy harvesting chips for IoT because we can't change all these batteries. So why don't you just give us a quick update about where Wiliot is now?
Yeah, it's been a long journey progressed very quickly since we last spoke. And so 10 generations of chips later, we have a computer the size of a postage stamp which powers itself by harvesting radio frequency energy. It can harvest energy from Bluetooth and other frequencies. So we'll be announcing a version 2 chip that can harvest energy from the same bands that are used by LoRa. And it actually is a computer, even though it's postage stamp size. So it has 3 cores, an ARM processor, RAM, ROM. It senses, it communicates securely over encryption. And since we last spoke, we also now have turned into a SaaS company, or a sensing as a service company, because we've figured out if you're going to go from billions of IoT nodes to trillions, that's a lot of data, and you need edge computing and cloud computing to make sense of it.
So we see this a lot. We see a lot of the, I'll call it the hardcore infrastructure, like chips, gateways, even specialized sensors. Companies they start out, I'm going to build the hardware or build the silicon, and then they're like, let's offer it as a service. So can you talk to me about why y'all decided to do that?
Good question. There's some business reasons and there's some technical reasons. On the business side, we wanted to remove one of the biggest speed bumps to adoption of this internet of everyday things technology. One of the first questions that people ask us about is the cost of the tags. And so we decided if we actually provide our IP at zero cost, if we don't make any money from tags, then we can enable people to embed them into everything they make. Because realistically, if we work with apparel companies and reusable plastic container companies, they're not going to get value from everything immediately. So if we essentially provide our piece for free and allow companies like Avery Dennison, who are one of our partners that turn our chips into smart labels, if we don't load the cost of the tag and we just let them do their thing and only charge for the service, then it removes that speed bump. It allows us to only start charging when the pallet or the item of clothing starts to deliver value, because you know what the inventory is throughout the entirety of your supply chain. Or in the case of vaccines, you understand the temperature of the vaccine vial. And realistically, not every vaccine vial will have the infrastructure and the business relationships in place to support that. So there's a business reason for doing it, which is this removal of the speed bump. But then there's some technical reasons. When you start embedding intelligence at this scale, where maybe there's 50 or 100,000 radios all broadcasting in a store or a warehouse, that's a massive amount of data, and it's data that needs to be kept private. And so the way you put a traffic cop in there and mitigate the tsunami of data is you start to put intelligence in at the edge, you start to put intelligence in the cloud. You also have logic that enables privacy control and data ownership, and that requires the cloud as well. So those are really the two sides of why we shifted from being a chip company to being a SaaS company, a sensing as a service company.
You are aware that there's already software as a service companies out there. I feel like this acronym, it's going to make my life more difficult. Okay. So let's talk about what it takes to move from being a chip company to a sensing as a service company. You've got to build your own cloud. You've got to establish partnerships, a whole ecosystem of vendors. Y'all are still designing the chips, but someone else makes them. So break that down for me. What does that look like?
Yes. So we don't, even though we do a lot, we certainly can't do it alone. And we have a really broad set of partnerships. And when we went to market, we had so much interest in what we did. It's actually one of the worst things about working at Wiliot is there's just so many things you could do and you can't do them all. So we decided to focus on a set of use cases and a set of partners. We have some really large customers, which helps when you're recruiting partners. And those partners fill out a lot of aspects of the solution. So we have partners that take our chip and turn it into a sticker. So that's a process that we borrowed from the RFID industry. Unlike most Bluetooth tags, there's no printed circuit board. Our chips are mounted on paper using a process that was perfected by the RFID industry. So we've partnered with the people that make the machines, that make the tags. We've partnered with the people that buy those machines and produce billions of tags and have their own ecosystem of partners who can wrap those tags in paper or plastic or silicone, depending on where the intelligence is going. We then partner with the people at the edge. So there are companies that... one of the great things about using Bluetooth is that a lot of the infrastructure is already there. That's one of the things that's held back IoT is the cost and the process of deploying infrastructure. Our tags talk Bluetooth. And guess what? We have Bluetooth devices all around us. I don't need to tell you about that. Smart speakers, phones, Wi-Fi access points. But sometimes if you want predictable performance, you want some extra bridge devices in there, devices that can create a reliable source of energy and relay signals to some of those gateways. So we partner with all of those companies, the giants in the Wi-Fi world, a lot of the niche companies that have really cool angle of arrival technology and other Bluetooth-related good stuff. And then in the software world, we work with companies that make the applications. And sometimes those are really gigantic supply chain companies. But there's also a whole raft of companies that are focusing on this trend to serialization, where each product, rather than just being described by a generic SKU, a stock keeping unit that says, oh, you're a blue sweater, now apparel companies are giving like a digital passport to each individual blue sweater. It has its own ID, and there are companies out there that specialize in that. And so we work with them. And then lastly, there's the service companies, the people that can take this technology and deploy it over 10,000 retail stores. And then there's the systems integrators and the strategy consultants that are really important because this is actually changing the way companies run their business. And it's not a decision that can be made just by, a director can make a decision on this. But if you're going to turn your company into the kind of organization that can take advantage of this technology, then it really takes board level and CXO level decisions. And so we work with companies like Deloitte, who can help quantify the value and what the new skills need to be to take advantage of this technology. So a lot of partners.
Yikes. Yes, that is a lot of partners. And I think we've talked about serialization with everything, which is a company that also does tags. Okay, you offered me so many, it was like catnip. Like I'm like, oh, what kind of skills do people need? Oh, this is so fascinating. Let's talk more about serialization. But no, we're not going to do that. We're actually going to talk about the demand chain because you brought this concept up. And this is actually when Kevin Ashton described the IoT, this was actually what he was thinking about when he was back at, P&G. He was thinking about having an individual passport on every item of lipstick so he could tell when they were out. So let's talk about the demand chain and what that's going to bring for companies.
Incredibly excited about this move from supply chain to demand chain because I think it's an opportunity for great profits, but it's also an opportunity to save the planet. I don't know about you. I kind of sometimes pop my head out of this IoT world. I look at what's going around us and I think, oh my goodness, this is just really bad. What can I do to help? And then I suddenly realized, oh, we have an incredible opportunity with demand chains, because essentially demand chains are the next generation of supply chains where the demand for a product is linked back to the manufacturer of the product. And that's with IoT at the item level, with tags, Bluetooth-enabled computers in everyday things, whether they're in apparel or vials of vaccine or food containers, suddenly brands have the opportunity to get visibility of what happens after their products leave the shipping dock, which was normally where things got pretty hazy. Now, if given that there's Bluetooth in stores, there's Bluetooth in homes, There's even Bluetooth in delivery vehicles. You can start to measure where everything is. You can get real-time shelf inventory of your product in stores. One of our customers has got 100,000 retail outlets. So you imagine making enough stuff to make sure that you never are out of stock in 100,000 retail outlets. And it's impossible. You either make much too much, or if you don't make enough, then you're out of stock and you're losing sales. So the idea of the demand chain is with very low-cost Bluetooth infrastructure that may already be in the store, you can see how many of your products are on the shelf. You can understand if there's an out of stock. And if you know that, you can actually make a lot less product and avoid the out of stocks that get in the way of sales. And you can also move from milk round deliveries to dynamic deliveries. So you can have smaller vehicles taking shorter routes to replenish exactly what is required, rather than just having 100 of everything in this vehicle. And in that way, I think it's one of the best opportunities we have to fight climate change is by optimizing our supply chains. And the great thing is you don't need to be a tree hugger like I am in my spare time. You just need to be interested in cutting the capital employed in inventory and seeing a better lift in sales. And it turns out that all brands want that. So that's really what the demand chain is. It's the next generation of the supply chain where suddenly brands know what the inventory level is of their product throughout the entire supply chain.
It's almost as if you're taking, you know, historically, by historically, I mean for the last, you know, 1,000 years as opposed to the last 20, local economies, they understood exactly where their stuff was going. But now you're going to be able, in globalization, change that. But now you're going to take globalization and bring it back down to a local level or a local level of understanding. But here's my question, because what you're describing also, it really feels closer to just-in-time manufacturing that has gotten us into a bit of a kerfuffle. You know, right now, coming out of the pandemic, our demand and our supply is so mismatched for a lot of reasons. But I don't know how what you're suggesting would affect a problem like what we're having today. We've kind of over-optimized.
I get your point. We're running this lean supply chain, so the slightest bit of disruption means that you get very big problems. But actually, I feel like what we have is the antidote to that. And if you think about a lot of the shortages we have, very often it's not that there aren't enough products. It's that the products are in the wrong place at the wrong time. We have hoarding. We have surplus in even within a hospital. You can have people that are kind of scared and they're stockpiling, or they're simply, you know, everyone's running around and they're super busy. So one of our use cases is actually another aspect of demand chain, which is optimizing consignment of products. And in hospitals, a lot of products are just delivered by the vendor into cupboards, and then the nurse grabs them and takes them and signs a bit of paper to say that they've taken them. Well, you can see where that breaks down very quickly. If you have simple, low-cost Bluetooth devices, something that can cost like $30 or $40, in each of those cupboards, and you know the PPE levels, you know the number of vaccine vials, then you have this incredible opportunity to smooth it out, to balance it out, and have visibility. If you start leveraging the telematics devices that are already in a lot of these containers, and you can understand the temperature and the inventory levels, then you can respond to this demand for lean supply chain with a lot more information that makes lean actually viable and more reliable and more robust.
Okay, well, we will hope. And then finally, since you're a self-described tree hugger, I want to ask about sustainability, because, you know, we're putting a computer on possibly one day hundreds of thousands, billions of things. And computers have tiny parts of sometimes toxic metals. It makes it hard to recycle the packaging we might have. So let's talk about thinking about sustainability in this product and how it gets applied.
Yeah, it's a really important question, and it's a really interesting question. You kind of can get into the, those solar panels have a carbon footprint kind of argument about things. So I believe the savings from deploying this technology massively dwarf the carbon footprint, which is a real thing. And we do our best to mitigate the laws of physics that say that, you know, it takes energy to make something. So we are adding something extra, but it's tiny. You know, these chips are absolutely minuscule in size. So the amount of silicon is negligible. Our partners like Avery Dennison have been looking at this challenge for not just a few years, for many years. And so they're working towards doing great things that make these tags recyclable. So basically, almost everything can go through a reprocessing process, the kind of things that waste management and others have. The kind of the last piece that we're working on is actually the glue that glues the silicon to the antenna. So that's something that we are working on. But I think the real opportunity is dwarfs some of the challenges that we take seriously and are working on. And it's the opportunity to, A, you know, massively cut the amount of product that's in the supply chain, you know, by very significant amounts that can have a material impact on climate change. But it's also accelerating the circular economy. You know, just one example of that is in your wardrobe. I don't know what your wardrobe's like, but mine is stuffed full of things that I haven't worn for years. Imagine if there were tags in those apparel items that could remind you, hey, Stacey, you know, you've got half of your wardrobe you haven't worn for 2 years. How about if I actually give you an opportunity to find another home for that? And how about if you get some value back, maybe money or something else that allows you to buy something else that is better, that's higher quality, that has a longer lifetime? And I really believe that this technology can help us move away from fast fashion and make some of these apparel companies the Netflix of apparel, where you subscribe to really good clothing that is either very fashionable or higher quality and has a second life. And you can do that if you know reliably what's in the wardrobe and you can track the provenance of that product. And you know, where is Bluetooth in your home? Well, it's in the washing machine. So why not track how often products are washed and therefore know how much life there is left in them? So there's a lot that can be done. And it's, you know, one of the things that makes me excited about this technology.
That just terrified me, because now I'm imagining my skinny pants telling me, hey, you haven't worn me in 3 years. Are you? And I'll be like, no, I don't need this kind of gut check from a pair of pants. But
it's not for everyone, that's for sure.
But this also raises the question of my stuff after I come home with these tags. It's essentially going to be spying on me. And that feels spying. I'm using a loaded term on purpose, because I think done poorly, and it will be done poorly, it will feel like that.
Yeah, privacy is not just important, it's essential. This can't be an opt-out, it has to be an opt-in. And to be frank, most of what we're focused on is focused on the in-store experience. We've done some work in the home in one of the major Asian markets. We've had these tags on food containers to look at extending the shelf life of product. And I think we only get to go into the home if there's real value and we prove that this is, you know, we're doing the right thing around privacy. So we made the decision very early on, shortly after our first conversation back in 2017, I think it was, to only sell tags where encryption was enabled. And we've had offers for literally billions of tags if we turn off encryption. But if you do that, then you've suddenly lost control of the chain of ownership of that data and accountability for privacy. When you have an encrypted ID, then you have the ability to say, well, who's responsible for GDPR? Who's making sure that this is an opt-in rather than an opt-out? And then it comes down to, respecting the law, and also proving to customers that there's actually something in it for them.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I feel like we've learned a lot.
Stacey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyoniot.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.